Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. As I said during the mascot bracket, that is not the traditional episode for this week. Instead, that is with Mo DeKeel of the Nerder She Wrote podcast, writing at Bleacher Report, and we have a really fun conversation. We start out talking about the West and some of the nuances with the playoff race and the significant recent injuries to Brandon Ingram, Kevin Huerter, and others. And then we end up meandering into a really interesting conversation about the challenges of team building and evaluation and the pressures that these teams are going to be under, not only to do well, but how they respond to either success or failure in the playoffs. And I thought it was a really fascinating conversation and got into free agency, got into philosophies on trades and everything else. And conversation runs a little bit more than an hour. I think there's a lot of great stuff in here, and it is brought to you by Prize Picks. Download the Prize Picks app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. And here's Mo. Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Danny, for having me.
There's a lot going on around the league, even though the NCAA tournament is, of course, taking a lot of the oxygen out of the basketball room, not always necessarily for us. But I want to start with the LA teams, the closest teams for you geographically. Paul George said almost a couple weeks ago that the Clippers didn't really have an identity. Are you having trouble getting a read on this team, or do you think you have it?
I think I have it. It's just not great. It's just not. Like, here's the thing. We know what the team's top level is. We saw it when they went on that run, the Grammy road trip, everything that they did. Like, they really flat out killed it. And then you had some things happen. Like, I don't think people understand how important Russell Westbrook is to them. Like, we can make all the jokes that Lord knows I do it all the time, Danny, but like about his play and whatnot. But his energy off the bench is the most important thing for that team, besides the obvious health thing we're worried about. But his energy and the juice he brings for those guys matters. And I think the most important thing that the Clippers need is to constantly have that push. And I think that's the identity. If they don't have that push, they're a team that goes through the motions, and you see what you've seen over the past few weeks. And they've looked sloppy at times, and they look uninterested at times. And you're really trying to get that handle on them. It's I kind of call it like they're too cool for school sometimes, and I think that's their identity, unfortunately.
I like that as a way of phrasing it, and the Westbrook absence is also a reminder of something that is both true, that is true for them and honestly for almost all of the second apron teams, which is that the Clippers are really shallow. Like, they don't have enough players, whether it's that Ty Lue trusts or whether it's that are actually good enough. Those can be different things. They can be the same. We don't know. But when you know, Russell Westbrook, he's an imperfect player, but he does play hard and he does have positive qualities. And so when you're replacing him with significantly less reliable players, and it's the same whenever pretty much any of their guys is out, like, they don't have replacement starters, they don't have replacement bench players. So any absence makes a bigger difference for them than it does for some other teams.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of like, just when you look at it, look at who they're playing now as their backup point guard. It's Bones Highland. That's terrible. That's not a team that you look at that's going to win a championship, and you don't feel confident in that sense. And then it gets even worse. Like, if Harden misses a game, then Bones gets moved into the starting lineup, and you're really starting to struggle with this team and trying to figure out their sort of vibe. It's one thing that was said to me recently, and I didn't think about it until somebody said it, and I said, wow, that's actually a really great point. is part of their too cool for school comes from Ty Lue. Like, let me just ask you, have you ever seen him go off in a game? Like, we've seen Pop yell at guys. We've seen Spo go completely ballistic on guys during timeouts and whatnot. I can't pinpoint one game where I've seen Ty Lue go and just go get in a guy's face and yell at him.
I can't recall one either. I'm sure more eagle-eyed Clippers fans may, but yeah, you're right. It's not something I've ever really noticed, but I think I've noticed it because it doesn't happen. Or I haven't noticed it because it hasn't happened, I guess. Double negative.
Yeah, and so the as great as it is to not have a coach panic, and I agree with that 90% of the time, 95% of the time even, like there are moments where I think it matters to go off on your team, and I know some people will be like, you know, yelling at players and stuff now isn't a thing anymore and whatnot. I think it matters because then it shows the urgency. And I'm not trying to say Ty doesn't have the urgency. He knows what's at stake. But I think there's a level of like you take on your coach's persona, and I think that's where that stuff comes from. And then to go back to Russ, like then when he puts Russ in, it's just 1,000 miles a minute. you know, it's like such a drastic change. And I think that's where that kind of like urgency comes from the team is from Russ. And I think that's part of the thing that's kind of interesting with the squad.
One of the significant dynamics that I've been struck by in the last few weeks is that as soon as Karl-Anthony Towns went down, I'm like, oh man, the Wolves are definitely like they're the favorites for the four seed. And to their credit, I mean, they've basically held even, I think, with the Clippers since that happened. And part of that is the Clippers have had some guys out and they've lost some games that I thought they should have won, including that one against the Hawks. But should have won. I mean, they got their asses kicked, but in the sense of like structurally, like they have a better team than the Hawks do. And that, I mean, there is a lot of credit that needs to go to the Wolves, to Edwards on down and Chris Finch and everything like that. That, I mean, as we're recording this, they're three games clear of the Clippers in the loss column, four games clear in the win column. And we don't know at this moment in time what the difference between the three and the four seed is going to be in either the first round or the second round, because we don't know who the one or two is going to be yet. But it feels like, you know, normal arc, being the three is better than being the four.
Yeah, I mean, it just you feel a little bit more confident in, like, I'll just say it as the four seed, like, I'd kind of be worried about having to play New Orleans. Now, granted, the Brandon Ingram news just dropped, and so we're still trying to figure out really what that means for the Pelicans. But, like, that's a really bad matchup for the Clippers.
I mean, we saw it go really badly for them pretty recently.
Yeah, and I think the stuff that was most telling in that game, you know, was that, hey, Zion can guard Kawhi, you know, and do it enough to the point that, cool, the other wing players can guard the other guys for the Clippers, and that matters. That makes a big difference. And I know no James Harden in that game. I know they'd put Zion in the pick and roll. Cool. There was a way to figure that stuff out. It puts the Clippers in a much more difficult position. And then the other thing, man, the Clippers might not even have home court in that series. And we're talking potentially. I mean, they might lose that. I mean, they're only a game and a half up on New Orleans. And I think those are the things you're watching for that's a little bit concerning with them. And I think, you know, what you said about Minnesota was so right on. It's just like Karl-Anthony Towns gets hurt, Edwards goes up another level, you know, and even the game they lost against Denver, like, credit that Minnesota team, because I'll be honest, I saw the starting lineup. I was like, oh, man, no Cat, which we knew, no Gobert, no Naz Reid. You have Luka Garza having to take on Jokic, and they had a chance to tie the game at the buzzer. Like, that's
they were down 22, I believe, in the first half, and like came, you know, fought.
They took a lead in the fourth quarter. And then lost. But like, man, and they went toe to toe with the Nuggets with that. And whatever we want to talk about, Nuggets just kind of chilling or whatnot. But they went toe to toe in that stuff. That's not what you see with the Clippers. Kawhi Leonard against Minnesota goes out after the first quarter, and then the Clippers just completely fall apart. And they were up big on the Wolves, and the Wolves came back and won that game by a lot.
Yeah, it went from a blowout to a blowout. And I mean, losing Kawhi is obviously a big deal, but I mean, Gobert went out with a rib cartilage injury, I believe, or rib injury, might not have been cartilage in that one. And he missed some time after that. I mean, Minnesota, yeah, I mean, they deserve a lot of credit. And as we said, we don't know yet whether being the three or being the four is going to matter. Like, it might be that you end up wanting to be the four, but generally speaking, that's the way this works. And we can shift to the Brandon Ingram news. I mean, unfortunately, well, fortunately and unfortunately, Nate and I were broadcasting that game for League Pass, and Nate knows lower body injuries really well. And what the hope that we had was, like, okay, well, he's definitely going to, like, he's going to be out a little bit because it was looked like potentially a bone bruise or something else, and that's the contusion's what we got. But it looks like he avoided the more significant injuries. So the good news for the Pelicans is, knowing what we know right now, I would expect Ingram to be right or pretty dang close for the playoffs. How much before that is going to be an open question based on his recovery. And I cautioned myself because I just talked about how I automatically made this play with the Wolves and it was wrong. But this does seem to loosen up their grip on the five or better. Not that that grip was super strong in the first place. I mean, there are two losses ahead of the Mavs and the Suns and the Kings. So it wasn't that far ahead. But there's at least a chance that now it's the five through, whether you want to argue eight or 10, gets more fluid.
Yeah, I mean, it really puts them in an interesting position because it really felt like the Pelicans were finding their stride, you know, and how they wanted to play and how they want to focus on everything. And then losing Ingram kind of, you know, they spent so long trying to find the balance between Ingram and Zion. To lose that now is a bit challenging for them. And again, it's not, man, a bad week, Danny, and you could slip into the play-in tournament. Like, well, that's just how tight it is. I mean,
and not only that, but I'll go through their schedule over the short term. So they had that was a very bizarre game that we broadcast against Orlando, where full credit to Jamal Mosley, he identified the kind of shots that they were going to be able to get against the Pels. They missed all of them in the first quarter and then made most of them in the later part. And then Ingram got hurt. So they ended up winning by 15, I think, technically, but it was comfortable at that point. But so here's their schedule. So we're recording this on Friday. They will play Miami starting in just a few minutes as to when we're recording right now in Miami. Then at Detroit, you know, we think we know where that one's going to go. But then they have this very clarifying homestand. Thunder, Bucks, Celtics, Suns, Magic, and then Spurs at the end. So, like, there are six games, but five of those six games are against playoff teams. I guess technically we don't know if the Suns are going to make the playoffs or the play-in. And I've always said that the hardest games to navigate when you have a key player out are actually the ones that are close calls. Because if it was a clear win either way or a clear loss either way, it actually doesn't move the needle that much. But, I mean, Pelicans, Bucks could be huge. Pelicans, Suns could be huge. And so if they can make it through that 500, then they have a pretty soft end of the schedule relatively compared to that. But that's a huge stretch.
Yeah, it's a real challenging one. This is the, okay, we just have to find a way to win some of these games. Like, this is going to be the make or break. Are we going to be the fifth seed? Do we have the potential to move up to four? Or are we going to play in the play-in tournament? Like, it's literally that kind of dangerous. Because these are teams that are also chasing them. Like, that game against Phoenix is huge, huge for both teams. You know, for Phoenix to try to climb out of the play-in tournament and for them to and for New Orleans to try to stay out of it. Like, that's a massive, massive run for them. And I think they really need to kind of focus on that. And I think that's man, I can't say it enough. Like, these are big games for them, and it's going to be really challenging.
On top of that, they actually the Pelicans and Suns play again that same week. The one's going to be in Phoenix, so it's after the homestand. So it kind of broke the thematic thread. But that, yeah, I mean, the games that you play against your compatriots at this point, you know, kind of your spot in the standings. And then right after that, they have a game against the Kings a couple days after the second Suns game. It's like, well, that could end up being big too. And the Kings are going to be missing Kevin Huerter. How big does that go for them? It seems like Mike Brown is going to have Keon Ellis as the new starter. So that's a pretty different theory of shooting guard when you consider that they also have Chris Duarte and Malik Monk, who aren't the same, but are more similar to Kevin Huerter than Keon Ellis is. But Ellis gives them something in defensive playmaking that their starting group lacked. And so I want to see how the Kings react. I want to see how the Kings play for this next stretch. I mean, I think they're going to be without Huerter for the rest of the year, but we'll learn a lot more over the first few games about what they want to do here than later on.
Yeah, the Kings are in an interesting position because I feel like they're the team everybody wants to play in the playoffs. Like, they're
again.
And I don't mean this in a – I mean, part of it is just the West is so stacked. Like, when we're being honest with it, like, it's just – I mean, even the play-in tournament teams is one of those things where you're just like, man, that, like, it's just along the lines of, like, I don't want to play this team. You get LeBron and AD in the first round or Steph in the first round, like – You probably will win the series, but they're not going out without a whimper. At least I don't think so. And I think that's kind of the it's just like, does it have to be so hard? So the Kings are the team. Everybody's kind of like, come on, Sac, you got this. Like you can find a way because they want to play them. And I think that's a dangerous thing. And I think the Herter injury is huge. It changes their lineup composition. It changes, you know, the shots you're kind of looking for offensively, especially with that starting group, and trying to figure out how you're going to flow through everything and how you're going to kind of play and find that rhythm. I know Herter hasn't really had a great year, but I think, you know, it's interesting. But the other plus side, too, is Ellis helps their defense a lot. I love the way he defends, man. I think he's a bulldog, and I think it kind of gives them a different edge. It's now just figuring out, like, cool, do we know how to play this way? Because we've not really played this way very often.
And while we're circling parts of the schedule for these teams, first of all, they have a both at home a series against the Dallas Mavericks. That's going to be early next week. That's going to be huge. I mean, you think about where those two teams are seating wise and everything else. But then the Kings still have an East Coast road trip left. They play the Knicks, the Celtics, the Nets, and the Thunder. And so, like, I mean, that stretch is going to be big. And as you kind of the way you phrased it, I liked with the Pelicans, which is like if you can hold your head above water, that's probably enough. I mean, we don't know exactly where this part of the West is going to go. But for Sacramento, I mean, Herter is their, I mean, I think of him as their fifth best starter, but it is extremely important to have him, and it puts more pressure on the rest of everything else. And I think the way to pivot into that, and the Lakers will be an obvious part of this question. So last week I had Jared Dubin on, and one of the questions I kind of ended with him was, we have these real blue bloods in the 7-10 right now in the West, though right now technically Dallas has actually moved past Sacramento, so they're in the 6. But the question that I asked him was, these teams obviously have a great reputation, and you could argue that one or two of them are different for different reasons, but are they more reputation than actual quality right now? Like, when we think Lakers, are we thinking about an accurate iteration of the Lakers, or are we thinking about something different than what they are?
God, it's such a hard way to kind of answer it, and I'm gonna thread the needle here a little bit and just kind of say, like, it's a bit of both. I think we think the Lakers are a little bit, when I say we, I mean the royal we, and I mean the media.
Sure.
Think highly of the Lakers, than more highly of the Lakers than we should. Like, the number of questions I've been asked of, like, can the Lakers go to the finals? You know, on, like, radio hits and whatnot, I just constantly roll my eyes. I'm like, can the Lakers get out of the playoffs? Like, can they get out of the play-in? Like, can they get, you know, it's they're so wildly inconsistent that it's hard to say what you get with them. When they're on, they're really good. Like, they're good. Like, they can play. They know how to play. And that, but that's dependent on guys who are inconsistent. That's depending on D'Angelo Russell being, you know, knocking down shots. That's counting on Rui Hachimura, you know, being much more active as a cutter. It's counting on Reeves delivering. There's a lot of stuff that needs to go right for them to just be on. And I think that's hard. And then I think, again, with, like, the Warriors – I mean, hell, Danny, like, we just got to talk about the fact Houston's chasing them. Houston might knock them out of the play-in tournament altogether, you know, and it's not a shouldn't be a shock to anybody right now. I mean, Houston's on a 7-game win streak, and I think we look at the Warriors, and every time it's like we want to believe, but you just see them struggling so much, and sometimes just completely no-showing games. It's hard to believe. I think we have an ideal scenario of the Blue Buds, but I don't think that's actually reality.
I'm pretty close to you on that. And I think one way of discussing this is that the Lakers this year, they've played over 3,000 clean the glass possessions with AD and LeBron on the floor together. And usually when those guys have been on the floor, it's gone really well. And the question has been, over these Lakers years, how often does that actually happen? Well, this year, you know, as I said, over 3,000 possessions, they're outscoring teams by 3.3 points per 100 possessions. That is not that much for a team that many would think of as good. Like, that's, you know, you want those lineups to be handling opponents a little bit more cleanly. And then if you don't have them together as much, or your other lineups are messed up because you don't have creators or all these other things, then it can happen. And that, you know, I think they were like a plus 6 or something like that in those lineups last year. And for the Warriors, I mean, it's honestly, it's in part a similar story. Like, early on in the year, it was like Draymond Green is missing all this time and everything else. And what I've been finding with them is just that even when things are generally going their way, unless they're playing like a clearly hurt team or something else like that, there's still a pretty significant chance they just lose. And that is what's so fundamentally different. And it's how teams age a lot of times. You know, like one of the ways that teams age is they lose that. I always think of it with the Spurs, though, of course, it hasn't been them in years, of the teams that never suffer fools, the teams that beat every one of the bottom eight teams in the league every single time. And like, yeah, the Warriors dispatched Memphis pretty cleanly on Wednesday, but they, you know, they lost, I think they've lost to the Spurs twice this year, or at least they came close in one of the other times. And then they've lost them like team to shorthanded opponents. They had that one against the Bulls, though I think Steph didn't play in that game. And I don't see them pulling off a run. Like, that's just the team that they have. Like, it's so bizarre. I basically said when Şengün got hurt, I'm like, congratulations to the Warriors for getting into the play-in, because I didn't think the Rockets were going to do this. And I still don't. You know, if I had to guess, I would say that the Rockets, they're still three games behind in the loss column, that they don't quite get there. But I am extremely encouraged that they're making this a race. And considering they likely don't have their pick this year, they're putting up a fight without like the organizational imperative to do so. It's playing the right way, building momentum for next year.
Yeah, but it's also just, I want to touch on the two things. One, just their race right now. Like, mark your calendars, folks. April 4th, they play the Warriors. That might be a massive game.
Could be.
Because when you look at their schedule, you know, just kind of going forward, they're on a 7-game win streak. They have the Jazz tomorrow. Portland, and both of those games are at home. They're at Thunder, at the Jazz, Dallas. That's a tough one for sure. Minnesota leading into that Golden State game. Miami, Dallas, you know, Orlando. And then they finish the season with Utah, Portland, and the Clippers. And the Clippers might not be playing for anything at the end of that. So their last three games might be games that are just like theirs to have. Like, it is a very wild situation right now that we have, and that game on the 4th might be just so unbelievably huge. That might be the play into the play-in, Danny.
It very well could be. And when you think about the context of where they might be going, you brought up the Rockets have a pretty soft schedule between now and then. The Warriors have a somewhat harder one. They have a home game against the Pacers on Friday, and then Minnesota, Miami on the road, and then that road trip continues. But after Orlando, it gets a little bit more beatable. But yeah, as you mentioned, like they have some more losses that'll probably come in there, and then play Houston, and then the Warriors schedule after that is a mix of harder games and softer games. Incidentally, both these teams play a lot of the Jazz, and playing the Jazz right now seems like a pretty good thing to do, because they're especially with Lauri Markkanen missing games due to injury maintenance that aren't necessarily like, I mean, he does have an injury, but aren't like, oh, well, he played in the last game and he's dealing with this. It's more like, yeah, we kind of want to keep our pick maintenance, yes, rather than injury maintenance. But yeah, I mean, the momentum is so funny, because, you know, we're recording this during the NCAA tournament, that like momentum doesn't have to matter going into the play-in, but it does feel like if the Warriors won't make it in with a ton of it at this point.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically playing. I mean, they're playing the play-in right now. This is it's not different than that run in the bubble when Portland had to go on a run to trigger the play-in game, right? And that was like, you know, and Dame had to play for your life every night. That's kind of what they're doing right now. They have a tiny, tiny cushion. Like you said, you battled this hard to get into the play-in tournament, and congratulations, you got the Lakers like two nights later. Like, there's a level of exhaustion there. There's a level of there might be energy because of the run you just went on to every night's been a playoff game basically for you. And then there might be a level of just the exhaustion. In the long run, it's going to hurt you, and I think hurts their chances.
Lots more to discuss, but first a message from Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America, the easiest and most exciting way to play DFS. It's just you against the numbers. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, you pick more than or less than on 2-6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in. And even better, you can now win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. You can turn $10 into $1,000 with NBA, NHL, and college basketball entries today on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. And football season may be over, but the action on the floor is heating up. Whether it's tournament season or the fight for playoff home court, there's no shortage of high-stakes basketball moments this time of year, so get in on the action with Prize Picks. where you can turn your hoops knowledge into serious cash. This is such a great time. I mean, getting into fun college basketball and, of course, pro basketball. And one of the things that I really enjoy about Prize Picks is that it's player specific. So if you think that a player, LeBron James, or a lesser light, I mean, you can nail those too, hopefully, that has a really favorable matchup or a really unfavorable matchup, all you have to do is pick more than or less than. It's also a great time to try out Prize Picks because if you download their app today and use the code CLNS, you get a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy at Prize Picks.
But I want to go back a little bit to Houston because I think there's something that's important. This run that Houston's on, even if they don't make the play-in tournament, it's so similar to Phoenix, you know, going on that run bubble a few years ago in the bubble and kind of what it led to and kind of creating that confidence and all those things. It's one, it's great that Şengün's injury is not as catastrophic as we thought it might be. But it's also allowed them to kind of play a little bit, you know, Amen Thompson at the five. Like, it's been like fun to kind of watch some things that they've been doing and the way they've been playing and going at things. Like, I've really enjoyed this stuff and allows them to kind of see what else they have in guys. Like, don't sleep on this. We're talking about momentum in the playoffs. This is momentum for the Houston Rockets for next season.
For the organization and everything else, it really is unfortunate that we don't get to see Cam Whitmore during this. Like, they can't even play all their young guys because some of them are, of course, Şengün is young as well. But yeah, there's a lot that you can build on from it. And one of the other fascinations you brought up before, the importance of the regular season, is these are generally some older teams in this group, and that's not a surprise for various reasons, but remembering that the absolute best you can do as this seven, you know, going into the play-in, is to win that game and then be the seven seed. So it's not like you can make it out of that, and as things are looking right now, and get like a soft opponent. We don't know that you're going to face the Nuggets, who are the defending champions, but OKC is pretty dangerous too. And will a team like the Warriors or the Lakers, I think they'll get up for those games no matter what, but it's not like you're doing that to get a clear shot at the conference finals or something like that. It's going to take a big lift to get even through a round.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, and that's the problem with the West up and down, right? Like, there are no, I mean, I took a shot at the Kings earlier. They're not an easy out.
No.
It's despite maybe what teams might think. There are no easy outs in the West. Like, honestly, like, you know, sure, somebody might get swept or whatnot, but it's not an easy scenario with what you look at. I mean, if you're OKC, like, holy crap, you might get the one seed and get the Lakers in the first round. And that's been a terrible matchup for OKC. They might win the series, but it might cost them the playoffs because they might have to battle in a way they haven't and exhaust themselves, and now they're in trouble. Like, it's gonna be a wild playoffs, Danny. Like, I know I don't sound it in my voice, but it's going to be exciting, and it's going to be something that, like, we're really going to talk about, I think, for a while, just in the sense of, like, man, the Thunder will be favored if they play the Lakers in the first round. I don't think it'll be favored by a lot. You know, I think the one team that we might have the most confidence in the West is Denver, just because we've seen them and nobody has an answer for Jokic. But, like, man, just again, the West is just so ridiculous this season.
It's a fun throwback. And the other significance of that is that not only your level of play, but your level of health is going to matter a lot more. And so we've seen some injuries, Towns and Ingram and Şengün and everything else, affect the road to this point. But one of the other elements that I've been thinking about, now, incidentally, I was thinking about it in the Nuggets-Wolves game when the Nuggets were largely healthy, was these, like, even like a sprained ankle that costs a guy a week, that's going to make, you know, those are going to happen in the playoffs, and those are going to make a huge difference. And not only the threshold of that from a cumulative health standpoint, but the organizational challenges of that, where it's like there are going to be a lot of teams in the West whose seasons end surprisingly. Now, that could be surprisingly early, that could be surprisingly late, that could be because of an injury to themselves or someone else. But a lot of these teams are older. A lot of these teams have big decisions to make, not only in terms of who they keep and who they cut, but like overall level of spending and everything like that. And so how do the decision makers for the Thunder and the Clippers and the Pelicans and the Suns think about what happens, because there are a lot of ways it can go. And part of a, you know, I think about this with Presti a lot, but it's, you know, it's every single general manager in the league. A big part of their job is trying to convince their owner to commit to a spending level to make all that work. And there are like five teams in the Western Conference who could have a big shift based on how this goes.
Yeah. And I think the first thing you have to understand, and I think this is something all organizations need to realize, is don't overreact to the playoffs, good or bad, and don't get fooled by the playoffs. Like, a great example is the Atlanta Hawks, right? They made the conference finals. You know, we know the whole story with Ben Simmons and whatnot. And I think they deluded themselves a little bit into believing we're right there. We're right on the cusp of it. You know, we're so close right now. And I think that was from top down, from management all the way to the players, to the point that Trae Young said, like, well, when you've done what we've done, you know, it's hard to get excited for the regular season. Well, didn't really work out for them well since then. And I think it's just a matter of don't be fooled by, even though you have this massive amount of success, understand the situation, how you got there, why you got there, and was it real success? Is it replicable? Is it something we're going to be able to do again and again and again? Or were there special circumstances that led to that? And I think those are the things as an organization. Now in the West, if you're Oklahoma City and you get bounced by the Lakers in the first round or whatever, you just lose in the first round, I don't think it's the case to just overreact and let's, you know, team has a bright future, has so much assets. I think it's more just pinpointing what went wrong. And how do we fix it? And how do we, you know, how can we maneuver from there? I think it's having a, God, this is going to be weird. This is going to sound dumb. And you can just tell me, Danny, if I'm an idiot. Do you remember the show Newsroom on HBO?
Sure. A little bit. I didn't watch it a ton, but I watched it some.
Right. Just leave it for me to come up with like odd references of shows and movies.
And no worries.
They had a series where they were investigating a very bombshell story from like the Iraq War and the use of like chemical weapons. And at the end, when they thought they had everything sewed up, they had a group of people siloed to not know anything about the story. And they were the red team. They were supposed to come in and poke as many holes as possible into the story to find out if they had the story bulletproof or not. I think NBA teams need a red team to kind of analyze their team. I think they need somebody that's not there every day, that's not it, whether it's a consultant, whether it's a group of people, to kind of just analyze from the outside looking in and say, this is what we saw from the outside. Because I thought it was ridiculous when the Hawks thought they were so close, when I was like, man, you kind of got lucky. It worked out in your favor, you know, to a large degree. But like, you can't just bank on that and just think if we come back next season, we're going to roll that way. I think every Western Conference team needs a red team right now to just be on the outside and then look at the whole thing from a different view and perspective to whether they fail or whether they have unprecedented success that they weren't expecting, to understand whether that was real or not and then how to move forward. It's going to be such a valuable thing for teams.
Self-evaluation is so essential in these circumstances. And you framed it, which was completely fair, in terms of the team that exceeded whose performance exceeded their talent level. But it can happen the other way too, where the sky doesn't have to be falling just because you lost a series in a weird way. And I mean, there's an opportunity to reevaluate, but that is a perilous situation. And the fact that you kind of have to sit with it, especially if it's a loss, you have to sit with it for a few months and you can't really do much during that time. Like, I think there are situations where that has led to franchises being so antsy. And then the other element of it, which isn't as present for the West teams, but is for the Clippers most notably, because Paul George still isn't extended, is the players who can have a voice in this process. So, I mean, my full expectation is that Paul George is going to be a Clipper for the 24-25 season. Whether that comes via extension or new contract, I don't know. But there are circumstances where that shifts. There are circumstances where various different good players, and one of the fun things we know about the NBA now is it doesn't necessarily matter if you're under contract or not, decide this isn't what I want to do anymore. And there could go in different directions. And I don't think it's going to be like LeBron or anything like that. I mean, it could be. But the NBA has, you know, like I sometimes use the political term of veto players, but it has a lot of people who have to be on board in order for things to continue.
Yeah, for sure. And like the Paul George situation is going to be interesting. I'm with you. I think he's going to be a Clipper, but like it wouldn't shock me if he tries to go to Philly or my favorite team. I always put guys on teams and I'm like, this would be really interesting. I'd love to see if he found a way, if he was going to leave the Clippers, end up with the Knicks. Ooh. I think like that's a really interesting, I have no idea how they get him, all that stuff. Like just you know, if I could just go, you go here kind of situation, I think he's an unbelievable fit for them, and that makes the Knicks so incredibly interesting as a team to watch for next season. I just think the NBA itself, like, this is a wild, your expectations, you have to find a way to be realistic, and it's something, the goalpost moves during the season, you know, like when you look at Oklahoma City, like
or Orlando, like how their goalposts have moved.
Exactly. And I think the one thing, like Orlando is such a great example. I'm glad you brought them up, Danny, because like they're a team. Let's just assume they have a really bad first round and get knocked out. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen or anything like that. Let's just assume they get knocked out in the first round in five games. That is not a reason for this team to panic, to tear down things, to go get a scoring guard or whatever, or go chase Trae Young or whatnot. And I'm just throwing stuff out there. I apparently have a fascination with Trae Young today. But like it's more just, again, you have to step away and look, and it goes back to the self-evaluation. What were we thinking at the start of the year? What did we think in the middle of the season? How did we end? How we ended? Is this, can we find a way to, if we brought everybody back, is it going to be the same type of season? Are we going to, and obviously there's no predictions, easy to predict and know the future, but can we kind of expect, like, with the growth and development growth that we expect from these guys, that will be this? Or did Jalen Suggs just have an absolutely incredible year and we don't know if that's replicable, if that's something that could be repeated again and he's going to have that again next year? You don't know that. And I think that's the stuff that they have to start evaluating and figuring out. The biggest mistake they can make, though, I think, is just panic and feel like making a change to make a change. Denver is a good example of a team that had failure a couple of years, had injuries, and things kept derailing this team. But you would hear it, Danny, at the end of each playoff run for them before the finals. This team doesn't have enough. They need to make a big trade. They need to make a big move. There were the Kevin Durant demands a trade. And then you start hearing like, well, should they think about moving Jamal Murray for Kevin Durant or whatnot? Credit to the front office saying, no, we have what we need. Whether they believed it or not, who knows? but they whatever reason, they stuck with it, and now it resulted in a championship. Like, I think there's a element that I think these teams and organizations need to be very self-aware. And sometimes it's hard because you might have an owner that doesn't believe in no self-awareness. And that becomes now the front office's job of managing up. And I think there's just a lot of things that can really sort of derail these teams. Like Sacramento's an example. They had a great year last year. I thought they could have tried to do more in the offseason. And they're not having the year they had last year, even though they brought back the same talent. It's just everybody around them got better. I think it's just kind of being aware of your surroundings and who you are.
Absolutely. And another factor to throw in there, I'm happy you brought up the Magic, because they are a great example of another concept that I've been thinking about for the 24 offseason, which is the idea of an upgrade that isn't time sensitive. And so I don't know exactly what the best version of the Orlando Magic are going to look like. I think as great as Paolo has been, and Franz Wagner has, of course, shown a lot of wonderful signs over his years, that they will need that unless they're going to go just super hard defense, and I mean Suggs and everything else, like it can work. They're going to need somebody who's a better offensive player than anyone they have right now. But that does not mean the Orlando Magic have to do it in June, July necessarily at all. It just means they should be looking around. And that is a very complicated place to be. And there are a few other teams that potentially are in that ballgame. One of them that I've been obsessed with is the San Antonio Spurs, where Victor Wembanyama is having an amazing year. We're excited about it. And they're going to need a better offensive engine than Trae Jones. And that's not meant as a huge slight on Trae Jones. Like, I think even he, if you gave him truth serum, would admit that. Like, right. That unless he gets a lot better. But again, that doesn't mean San Antonio has to do that move right now. Doesn't mean they have to do it this summer. I do think that, and this has been flawed before, that you might want to go a little earlier with somebody as talented as Wembanyama, just on the idea that, a couple things. One of them is you're going to propel earlier, but another one is that they have picks from other teams, and so that can change the calculus here a little bit. They may still be bad next year. I think there's a chance. But once you run into a challenge with players like him, potentially, and like we saw this with Luka and a few others, where your draft equity starts getting worse because the player starts pushing you more, and so then you can't get into these conversations. So like you have a narrower window to get the difference makers that you need than you expected, and that's, you know, there's a benefit to having a little bit of a slow start or a false start developmentally. That's a part of what led OKC to all their stuff, also some good trades. But for the Spurs, you have this really challenging duality, because it's not only like, yeah, we will need this at some point to get better, but it's, we have one of the best young prospects in the league right now, one of the best, you know, period, over the last decade or so, if my evaluation is right, and numerous other people. So does that lead to the Spurs front office aiming higher? Because the idea is basically, well, let's bring up Trae Young again. Like, Trae Young, really good basketball player, obviously has some very distinct flaws, which may or may not matter as much with Wembanyama as some other players. But is Trae, as good as he is he good enough? Or do you want to say, hey, we want a guy who has real top 10, top 15 equity as an offensive player and can be maybe more viable in the playoffs? And there are credible arguments on both sides of that ledger.
It's funny that we brought this up, because I've been on a very, I don't think Trae Young makes any sense at all with the Spurs. And I don't, and I think the Spurs make a lot of sense to Trae Young, but I don't think he helps Victor Wembanyama as much as Victor Wembanyama helps them. Well, helps Trae Young. And I don't think that's, I think, you know, that for me is, I mean, I know that's not the point of what you asked, but it was such a trigger point for me. I just think it's just a small sort of thing. And I understand all of Trae's skills. His passing is unheard of. I mean, he's really good with his passing and whatnot. But I just think the level that the Spurs need from their point guard almost needs to be a step below Trae. Like, DeJounte Murray is a better fit for Victor Wembanyama, a better partner for Victor Wembanyama than Trae Young.
I disagree with you a little bit there, because there are wholesale changes that need to happen with the Spurs. But
absolutely.
But one of the basic problems this team has, which is low hanging fruit, is someone who just has a really good understanding of pass angles and like radius and all that kind of stuff, where it's like, just okay, this is a tall dude who has his hands right here. I have my hands over my head, not that mine are anywhere close to Victor Wembanyama's. And if you throw the ball there, your team's getting at least a point and a half. And the current Spurs see that window or don't see that window, and it goes by. And it's wild that a player can have that kind of a rule in the NBA because of how talented everyone else is. But there are all these circumstances where, I mean, this was really prominent for me in the game they played against the Rockets about a week and a half ago, where he could have gotten a dunk and just the ball never got even close, whether it was a bad pass or a tip pass or just no pass at all, which was the most common one. And as frustrating at times as Trae Young heliocentrism can be, I feel exceedingly confident that he will see and make that pass.
I agree with you in that he can make that pass. I don't know if he necessarily makes that pass as often as he should be, like when he has Victor Wembanyama. Like, it's in the sense of perfect. Clint Capella is perfect for Trae Young in that sense. Just a straight rolling big. This is all I want. I will take care of you from there. Victor Wembanyama doesn't need to be force fed in that sense. Yes, he needs touches. The Spurs have, there's no argument for me about the Spurs' inability to pass, but let's just be honest, Danny. Like, 90% of the league can't make a post entry pass anymore.
That's true.
It absolutely kills me. It absolutely kills me. But the when I look at it from Trae, I think a couple of things happen. Trae comes to this team and he goes, I'm the vet. I'm the one with the most experience here. I've been the furthest in the playoffs. I don't think he has the understanding and maybe not even the maturity to realize I'm the second best player on this team. Like, I don't think he understands, like, everything needs to run through Victor Wembanyama. My day needs to be thinking, every time I'm on the court with Victor, how do I make Victor's life easier? And I think, and sometimes that might be, I need to pull up from 30 feet. That might be the case from time to time. But I feel like he's going to do that. I think he's going to be thinking more, how can Victor help me? And I think that's the dynamic that comes into play when they if they were to trade for him is that. And then the cost of, okay, you're paying him this huge contract. And I know they have a ton. They have like so much cap space. But I think it's then there's guys that they're not paying that they could have gotten that could have been – we could have filled out more – our roster a little bit better, filled in more holes. I think they need to get better on the wing defensively. I think they, you know, and there's just a lot of things that they could do. In terms of Trey, like, I think Trey would be great with the Lakers. And I'm not just saying that because I'm in LA or anything like that. I just think he can fill that Kyrie role that LeBron had when he was in Cleveland. And I think, you know, sort of just having that guy that, hey, you can just go score and play. And I think he can do so much for Anthony Davis and make Davis's life easier in a way that I think he wouldn't necessarily help Victor Wembanyama. And I think that's kind of my big reluctance on seeing Trae Young with the Spurs. It just doesn't make sense to me. I just don't see how that works. And everybody always, you know, Victor will cover for Trae defensively. That's not the point. That's not really what you want. Like, Victor can do that, and that's fine. But I don't think on the defensive end, it's a plus for the Spurs. I think offensively, I think it's marginal improvement. Yes, he will make all the right passes. He can make all the right passes. Whether he will is a different story. I think you can get a guy that can make those passes, will make those passes, understanding that, hey, I'm not the guy. My job's to get the guy the ball.
It's a lot to think about. And I see where you're coming from with it. And we've also, like, I mean, Nate's brought this up a few times, and I mean, generally speaking, from what we hear, and we don't hear everything, it doesn't seem like players really enjoy playing with Trey for the most part, and that's a good shorthand. You know, like, he is ball dominant, and you can see that, but it seems like, at least to me, there is a different attitude, vibe, if you want to go that way, of, like, playing with Luka versus playing with Trey. And yeah, those guys are joined at the hip forever because of the trade and everything else, and because they're unusual, but they're parallel in certain respects. And so I think that you have that element of, like, well, if you're gonna make this bet, and as you said, even though the Spurs have the not only the salary cap space, but they have the assets to do something like this, like they could do that. I've spent a whole while on a previous podcast talking about all the stuff that OKC could do because of the resources that they have. But you still don't have that many chances, and it's hard to pivot because you want to give the bet you made time to play out and see where things are going to go. And because one decision closes the door on certain other ones, either from a sheer time perspective or from a resource perspective. And so the idea that I had about San Antonio aiming higher, part of the inspiration for that is the idea that you're trying to build, if you're trying to maximize championship equity, and that's in terms of number and certainty, then you need the strongest number two you can get. And it's good for the Spurs that they have some real ways to do that. We brought up how they have a ton of spending power. They also have not only a lot of draft picks, they have a lot of draft picks that aren't their own. And so what that means is, even if the Spurs take off faster than we expected, you know, maybe one of those Hawks picks ends up being juicy. Whether one of those, you know, the Bulls ones can't be too juicy because they're protected. But those matter not only in terms of the opportunity to potentially draft that difference maker, but also potentially the opportunity to trade for that difference maker. And so I would have real challenges. Like, if I were a consultant right now for San Antonio and they, you know, like, and you had an opportunity to get the 20th to 25th best offensive player in the league right now. I think Trey's better than that, but, like, let's say you could do that. And it came at a fair asset cost. I'm not saying it was, like, if you could get him for, like, you know, like the Bradley Beal trade, then yeah, of course. Like, that's a little bit of a case. But because that's going to take time and you're going to can move things in different directions. And so I think that they have it's probably 2 years, maybe 2 years plus an extra offseason to kind of get the dominoes in order. Just because if they haven't by that point, I could imagine there being tension within the organization, Wembanyama and everything else, like that would be too long. But just as a practical human consideration. And so does that mean you aim high this summer? Maybe you aim high next summer, but you're opportunistic if the right person becomes available? Maybe. Like that could be very reasonable there. But then the other thing that I was thinking about, and I'm like, you know, looking through the standings as we're talking, thinking about discussion topics, is the awkwardness with Brooklyn. And like, right. we get questions, you know, like mailbags and various things like that, but like, oh, the Nets like moving earlier. And it's like, well, I think that they need to wait until 25 for a couple of different financial reasons, like with cap space and everything else like that. But I do understand, and I'm exceedingly sympathetic, not only to the fans, but to the people who are involved in that organization, with the idea that they're having this like brutal end of the year, and that the most likely prescription that's coming is let's run it back.
Right. I mean, like the thing with like the decisions San Antonio makes right now, it's they're in a great position, and at the same time it's scary because it's like, okay, how will this, what ripple effects will we get from this trade or this move or this signing and things like that. I think the one thing too is it's not just finding a guy, a number two that say is in the top 25. It's finding the right number two that fits with Victor. And I don't, who knows what it is, right? Like it could be a variety of things. I mean, when Chris Middleton first got to the Bucks, I probably wouldn't have been running around going like he's the definite number two, perfect number two for Giannis, right? Like, you know, he was their closer at the end of the games in the championship run and things like that. Like, it's kind of coming up with the trying to find the right guy and then how can you get him with all that stuff. I think the Nets are in such a weird position because, you know, they're a team that I think fell in love with their evaluation of the team last season and didn't see the truth. And it's, you know, I think last season, Mikal Bridges had that phenomenal run to end the season, right? And he was doing all these things he didn't get the opportunity to do in Phoenix with the ball in his hands and things like that. And then everybody started touting him of like, that's your star. That's your guy. That's who you need to build around. And I just think from the very beginning, hey, that's not a guy I want to build around. Like that guy's, I don't think he's good enough. I think he just had a hell of a run with all those things. And I think they fell in love with that narrative and that idea that they found their guy already. And I think it screwed them to the point that even at this trade deadline, when they had an offer for him where they could have gotten all their picks back from Houston, like they balked against it. And I'm like, why? This is the perfect trade for you guys. You suck. Even if he is that guy, you're not going anywhere. He's with you and you're still losing. Like you know, it's, I think they're an organization that I think has fallen a little bit in love with themselves when it's like, you're not that great. And I think that's something that they need to kind of figure out in the off season is sit down and look like they're not going to get an offer for Mikal Bridges that good again.
Probably not, especially because the passage of time doesn't help. I mean, part of the reason has been so valuable is that he has this below market contract, but the longer you go, the less of the contract is below market because it, you know, it expires at the end of the 25-26 season. And it's so tempting. And I mean, I'm so sympathetic to the idea of like being optimistic, rising and falling with the team that you're working for and helped build in many cases, you know, like for Marks and these other people involved. And so when something goes well, you're like, yeah, like this is the way it's going to work. This is the way we're going to be. And again, that goes back to the red team idea. And it's just like, well, is it really there? And I mean, I remember, you know, I'm pretty sure I picked Brooklyn's under this year and I should have. And it was a similar story in some ways with Utah, where it's like, I remembered watching their games towards the end of last year and just being like, you know, like this isn't necessarily there as great as Mikal was playing. And the other part of that, which is so damaging, so challenging, is Nick Claxton. I mean, so Claxton last year had a wonderful defensive season. I thought the defensive player of the year hype was a little bit rich. But you run into this situation where you have a player who does this, you know, massive improvement for a stretch of time. And like so last year Claxton went, you know, he was like I'll use defensive EPM was plus 2.4 defensive EPM, which was at one point was one of the better marks in the entire league. And then the question that you need to ask yourself is like, okay, for the Nets to be as good as they like as good as they intend to be, Claxton has to be that guy again. Like that's the part of this story. And he's been hurt, he's been dealing with, you know, other stuff, just hasn't been as good defensively or offensively, also dealt with injuries. And one of the good shorthands that I use is if your success is dependent on a series of different players either holding firm or building on the best season they've ever had, maybe you want to pump the brakes a little bit.
Yeah, it's the scary proposition trying to figure out what's real and what's not, right? Like how much of this is again, something that we can, hey, we can count on this from here on out from this player. This is who they are now. And especially young guys, because development, it's not just a straight line, man. It's so step forward, step back, three steps forward. We took the leap. Okay, now he sucks, and now he's back again. And you know, it's so much like the stock market. And some of it's small incremental changes and improvements and whatnot. So it's so hard for these teams. And I think that's where the honest evaluation comes in. I mean, how many teams have we seen that just they fell in love with the prospect that they drafted and they developed, so they turned away a bad deal?
Yeah, or like, they took somebody else because they thought they had that filled, and then their initial evaluation was wrong.
Yeah, and there's a lot of guys. I'm not saying this like I get this right a lot.
Sure,
right?
It's just hard.
Yeah, it's an incredibly hard thing. Like, I respect how hard it is, and I think all these teams do and understand it. It's so wild in the sense of like, okay, now we're trying to figure it out. And then sometimes you go like, this is why we have the reactions where it's like, you gave so-and-so how much? Okay. Like, you know, I hope it pays off. I hope your analysis is better than mine in that sense. And it might be, they have more inside information. They know more details and obviously see them in practice and the work ethic and everything. There's just so many things that you don't know with this stuff. And that's why I find it so hard for some of these teams that are going nowhere. And I really mean it with Brooklyn in the sense of like, I don't know their direction. Like, we know San Antonio's direction. It's built through Wembanyama. They have a path. It's that really tall guy that nobody can miss. And I think it's, you know, Orlando, we know how they're going to build, and it's keeping the pair of Paolo and Franz together and figuring out the rest around them. But teams like Charlotte, I don't know their path. Teams like Brooklyn, I don't know their path. Wouldn't you want to just make sure you have as many opportunities as possible to build and go through it? Like, you know, the Mikal Bridges trade is one thing. The Knicks, looking at Nick Claxton as possibly somebody you might move on from. I know they're screwed with the Ben Simmons contract, but like, start trying to chart a path of like, okay, this is how we're going to build the team. I just don't think they know how they're going to build it. They just got a guy that had an unbelievable run at the end of the season last year and said, okay, that's our guy. And I think that's the problem. Like, it's not, there was no real thought behind it after that.
And they it turns out they needed it. I mean, also not helped by a number of guys just having worse seasons overall. I mean, Spencer Dinwiddie just turning into a pumpkin is very disappointing. And now he's on the Lakers and we'll see what his role is as things move forward. But like, another kind of bizarre situation like this, I don't want to dwell on it a ton, is like, what in the world happens to the Sixers after this, where they had this really good run when they were healthy, and it looked like the free agency momentum was sapping from them, not because of them, but because, you know, Siakam and Anunoby getting to places where it looks like they're going to resign, even if Penn has not gone to paper yet and won't. But then you have, like, Embiid gets out, you get free fall, and I don't know that that affects them with free agents at all, but it certainly affects this year, and it certainly affects, you know, how everything happens moving forward. And, like, it's another just brutal piece of context to consider.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about it with Philly, I mean, they were a team that was like, it was the number two team in the East, and now they're in the play-in tournament, you know, and they might get out of it and whatnot, but like, but even not just this year, but looking into next season, it is kind of a scary proposition of how you build the team, because you're now dependent on Embiid's knee and his health and stuff, and it's a scary way to kind of live in this environment right now. If you're Philly, the guy you sign needs to be a guy that can take over because we're gonna have to clearly rest Embiid games. He can't play back to backs. Like, I'm sorry, like they will have to manage his minutes for the rest of his career, and I don't mean like he can only play 25 minutes, but they need to manage the workload on him. It's just we have too much data to tell us otherwise. When he tries to push it, his body doesn't work with him in that way. And I think that's going to be a challenge for them as an organization to have to figure out, which then means when it comes to free agency, who are we going to get? And you're right. There's not a lot of guys out there. Like, Paul George is the one name. And then, like, who do you feel comfortable going like, hey, I'm going to pin my hopes on you, like in terms of free agency and not like restricted free agency, fully unrestricted free agents. There's not a lot of guys I'm out there all excited about.
Philly also doesn't have the resources to, like, because they'll have cap space and you can use cap space. The problem is if you're trading for a player who's good, it's going to take resources. You know, you're going to have to give up picks, or you're going to have to take on bad money or something else. And that's really hard to do. And so it's a tough place for them. And then I brought up how, like, the challenges that they have. And then the last one I can kind of end with on, like, how this can work is the giant question mark that is Donovan Mitchell. And so with Donovan Mitchell, like, the Cavs have, when they've been healthy, and honestly, at a lot of points when they've been unhealthy, they've been one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference. Mitchell has been an important part of that, of course. But he never chose to go to Cleveland in the first place. He has not yet signed a contract, you know, like in a circumstance when he had true freedom. I wrote a piece years and years ago, right before the decision, about the third contract and how that's definitive in the NBA, because that's the first time a player gets to actually put their voice in the process because of restricted free agency. And Donovan Mitchell, he's his own man. He can choose what he wants out of this circumstance, and he has earned that right just as every player has. But from the Cavs' perspective, it is such an awkward position because they've done well, though they had a brutal end of the playoffs last year, and we don't know where things are going from here. And the good news for the Cavs is that they have a strong core around that. And so theoretically, whatever Mitchell decides, they can work with. Like, they're not in a circumstance where it is a one-man band, and if he just leaves, then the franchise is in the wilderness for 10 years. Like, they're in a very good place with that. And theoretically, if he says, like, I'm not going to resign here, they can trade him and get something for him. He gets some good something for him. But it's also awkward, it's challenging, it's weird, because he can make that decision on whatever grounds he wants. It's possible it's a decision that he knew in his head before he even got to Cleveland. And whether that was conveyed or not, because he had no obligation to tell them, like, that is a circumstance. And so you can get into these spots where, like, the arc of the franchise is totally dependent on somebody who has their own evaluation, their own priorities beyond what you have.
It gets even harder for Cleveland if he's not telling them what he's going to do.
That's possible too, yeah.
Because that's the other thing. It's on his terms. He can divulge information as he wants. And I think it's, you know, yes, I want to be here in Cleveland for the rest of my career, but I want to wait until free agency. He can make more if he waits and then re-signs with Cleveland. Help me out here, Danny.
He can, but that's more about a fifth year. Because of the trade, he's not eligible for the higher max, even if he, like, makes all NBA and everything else like that. So it really is, and I used to bring this up with Anthony Davis back when he was on the Pelicans. I think the fifth year is generally overrated, but it's really about what the player thinks, because odds are, if you're good enough, you'll get paid in that year. It's just that it will come later as opposed to coming now.
Right. But so then there's that thing, like, you know, he could just say, like, I'll make more in the fifth, you know, I'm waiting for the fifth year or whatnot. But now the team has to sit there and really, especially if he doesn't say anything, it's to sit there and go, like, okay, we know Donovan Mitchell is going to be a free agent at the end of the year. We can't lose him for nothing, but that's a distinct possibility, assuming these teams have cap space. At that trade deadline, what do we do? We have a nice offer here. We don't want to trade him, but we have a nice trade offer for him. That's pretty good. Let's say it's like 80 cents on the dollar. But, like, you know, it's not amazing, but it's something like it's better than if we lose him for nothing, which we're not sure is possible. Like, man, the amount of sleep I would lose as the GM right now of Cleveland with just that possibility of a decision is ours. Like, I'd be terrified of it. That's the hardest part in this game for these front offices when they're building their team. And you're right. If he leaves for nothing, they're still in a good situation. They have Darius Garland. They have Evan Mobley. They have Jared Allen. Like, they have stuff, you know. Or do they have to make a trade at the trade deadline to try to convince Donovan Mitchell to stay? Like, there's just so many different caveats to it. And when you make that trade, does that put us in even a worse position should he leave?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
well,
say that.
Yeah, the moral hazard sort of circumstances. And then there the card that Kobe Altman can play if he wants to, and I would, in Mitchell's case, I would probably do this, is you can say, you can make whatever decision you want, but we will treat it that if you have not agreed to an extension by September 1st, that you are not going to resign with us. That doesn't mean we're going to trade you necessarily, but that is going to be our assumption. And then whether that pushes him in either direction. And because basically what you want to know as the Caps, if he hasn't provided this, and he very well could, and that may or may not become public, it usually does, is we want to know what your approach to this commitment is. And is it like, if we make the strongest offer we can, that you'll re-sign? Is it we make the strongest offer we can and you'd rather go somewhere else? All those sorts of circumstances. And it's a lot to take in. It's a lot to take on. But I the reason I would go with that kind of, and you know, you're not bound by that. It's not like you've signed a blood oath, right, that if he doesn't sign, you're going to trade him, is because of the strength of their overall situation. Even though Mitchell, to me, has been their best player since he got there, they not only can they, would he have value around the league, and that could be various teams that think he's going to re-sign, but also you could either maneuver that, either you do it within the trade or you do it in a separate deal to make a good version of the Caps. So if you can do a, it's a lot easier to make a Donovan Mitchell trade in the offseason, and you lose the possibility of re-signing him, you lose these other things, but then you can figure out, okay, so if Garland, Mobley, and Allen, and presumably you're keeping all three of them, you could theoretically make a corresponding trade, then what makes the most sense there? Is it okay, you pencil in Strus as one of the starters, then you go for either a more ball dominant or less the ball dominant player? Like, you can go in those different directions, but that is so much easier to do in the off season than it is in season, and that your potential trade partner gets him for the whole year as opposed to getting him for two-thirds or whatever.
Absolutely. Then it becomes the question at the trade deadline, is he a rental? Right,
exactly.
The team that's trading for him is this a rental? Like, we have no assurances, so it becomes a very, changes the offer quite a bit, and I think it just becomes, this is kind of the fun stuff in terms of the strategy side of planning a team and team building in the front office. It's dangerous hell. It's gambling. It's stressful.
Well,
you don't know what's going to happen, but you got to go with it.
I'll throw one more out there, and it's the corollary of Donovan Mitchell, which is the teams that want Donovan Mitchell. And so whether we're talking about it in terms of potentially trading for him, the 2025 cap space derby is going to be significantly more compelling than 24, because even though we don't know which of those players, and we probably won't for a while, like there are some high-level guys who could be free agents in 25. I'll just throw some names out there. Lauri Markkanen, Jason Tatum, Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson, Jamal Murray, and there are other, Brandon Ingram without an extension. So some of them inevitably will resign. I mean, that is the general arc. That's what's happening in the league right now, and I see no reason for that to change. Markkanen in particular, because of the renegotiation option. I'll write about that soon. But so if you are a team like, I was going to say the Knicks, but the Knicks are a little bit more complicated. The Nets, we brought them up earlier. How aggressively are you going to keep your powder dry, however you interpret that, because of the possibility of one or more of these guys being interested in you? It's such a weird place, because in that circumstance, in some ways, you're also sacrificing typically your team quality right now for something that may never come to pass.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a funny situation of that's kind of what happened to Philly, right? Like, mm-hmm. we heard the rumors that they were in on OG on the trades and Pascal Siakam, but then they said, no, we'll just wait and try to re-sign them. We'll try to sign them in free agency. And that kind of burns you. I'm of the philosophy of, like, I think waiting till free agency is just way riskier, because it's just, there's always some team that's going to create cap space somehow.
Yeah,
weren't ready for.
I'll throw one exception, which is unless you are like the Lakers. Like, if you right. are one of the absolute markets, and even then, it is still dicey.
And I would say, actually, it's probably only the Lakers.
Yeah, because the Knicks don't have that. I mean, the Knicks tried it, and it clearly didn't work.
Right, and I think that's kind of the... And by the way, it didn't work for the Lakers for a while.
True.
They couldn't even get a meeting with Kevin Durant, remember? And I mean, like, that's the kind of stuff. So it is a scary proposition in that sense. I mean, yes, it's a question of asset and cost benefit analysis and all that stuff, but you get an extra half year with the guy and you know, really can kind of go from there. And I think those are the things teams have to really decide upon, of like, how much do we think, if you're the Nets, like, keeping the powder is dry, it's fine. I mean, besides the year where you got KD and Kyrie, and I think that was kind of special circumstances, you haven't really been a destination. You know, and I get it. You're in Brooklyn now and all that stuff. But, like, I don't know. That's just a scary way to live off of. You know, it's Because what happens if Miami finds a way to clear up all that cap space? I mean, when I was with the Clippers, Elton Brand coming off of an Achilles injury, you know, we signed Baron Davis to the deal knowing that we're going to have Elton Brand. Well, Philly makes one or two moves, clears cap space, boom, Elton's gone. Like, there's always, and what I'm saying is, like, kind of preparing your, keeping the powder dry, keeping your cap space clear.
I mean, it sounds like it was even closer, the Rockets with Brook Lopez.
Right. You know, and just keeping your cap space clean, and it's great, but, like, you have no assurances because, you know, Pat Riley opens up space, and all of a sudden, the guy wants to go there now.
Yeah.
You know, and you're in trouble.
They are. So, there are so many other things we could just, but what I want to end this with is, over the next week or two, what teams, what situations are you going to be watching most closely?
Gosh, just so, I mean, obviously locked into just the seeding battles of all those teams, especially in the West, the play-in tournament, you know, from Dallas and keeping an eye and seeing how they handle things and where they go to watching Houston try to chase Golden State. And then I think in the East, I'm keeping an eye on Miami just because, God, Danny, they just don't die.
They don't.
They annoy me because they don't take the regular season seriously, and it pisses me off. But they just don't die, and they might actually squeeze into the out of the play-in tournament. And, I mean, you know, that's just like if you're the 3 seed and Miami ends up the 6 seed, you're just rolling your eyes going like, are you freaking serious? You know, and that's the team I'm like really kind of keeping an eye on.
That's a great one for me. My number one is OKC Denver. Just how that's looking. I mean, the jockeying for those two teams. I don't believe they don't play each other the rest of the way. But if OKC can hold them off, we don't know if that necessarily leads to a better first round matchup. But the dynamics there are really compelling. Denver, like, I mean, they've been playing really well as of late. I mean, the only game they've lost in, I think, the last 2 weeks was that Kyrie amazing buzzer beater. That's their only loss in the last 2 weeks. Yeah, and their only other loss since Valentine's Day was an overtime game against the Suns. So, yeah.
It's what's funny about it is I actually didn't think Denver was going to go for the number one seed, you know, and leading into the All-Star break, and the way they've come out after the All-Star break, you're just like, wow, okay, they actually really want the one seed again.
Well, and they're also so good that they can have games where they're a little bit off. I mean, I remember that one against the Raptors a few weeks ago where they were down at halftime. And, and then they just handled it because they can. And when the games they've gotten up for, I think generally speaking, they've looked very good. And so OKC, like, it's a cool little test for them. And one of the things that I enjoy in the late regular season, even when some games are less competitive, is getting a sense of players who are new to that grind. And I remember this when I was covering, you know, like I was around the Warriors a lot their first couple of years doing this, where the end of the regular season really mattered for them. And it was, you know, trying to sustain that over a month or two going into the playoffs. And so the idea of like having to get through all that. And so for OKC, that is a very different challenge for them. And they're handling it well so far, but we still have a month left in the regular season and we will see how they handle it from here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm fascinated to see them in the playoffs.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for having me, Danny.
Thanks again to Mo DeKeel for taking the time to come on. You can listen to him on podcasts on The Athletic, including Nerd or She Wrote. You can read his work at Bleacher Report, and you can follow him on social media if you don't already. Love his enthusiasm, love talking with Mo. And we didn't really have a plan for this episode, but we ended up in a truly fascinating place. And it was funny, we talked about maybe doing like 45 minutes, but then we ended up talking for an hour 15 and just got into some really fun stuff there. You know, I love those sorts of things. If you want to support Real GM Radio, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing, Apple, Spotify, whatever. And if we're not in a podcast player you want us in, please let me know and I'll pass that up the chain. You can also help other people find the show. That's by leaving a rating and review, social media, word of mouth, all of that's greatly appreciated. The single most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. And for this episode, that is Prize Picks. Download the Prize Picks app today. Use the CLNS code for a first deposit match up to $100, which is very exciting. Love having them on board. And you can also check out my other work, Dunked On Prime. It's a big part of the year. We just finished up position rankings for all five positions. That's building to top 10 players, which should be coming in the next week. and gamers and 15 and 60s, and we have a lot of end of the season catch up stuff, like how we did on over unders and everything else. So a lot of really good content there. And we also still have the NBA strategy stream. There are only two left as of when I'm recording this outro. We have Sunday, which is going to be Cavs Heat, should be a really fun one. And then we'll be doing the following Monday. So we're not the coming one, but the following one after that. And we love doing it. I've had some really fascinating games this year. And you can check that out either live, or you can actually watch it after the fact. It is in, if you have League Pass, it's in the NBA's feeds, and you could do that. I don't know how many people watch games after the fact, but you can. If you were going to watch that game, you can watch it with us talking about it. And then I have written work, of course, at The Athletic. Should have some stuff coming out soon. I had a piece that's pretty much done, and I haven't submitted it to editorial yet, so that's on me. And then, of course, we're figuring out what, if any, broadcasts we're going to do during the playoffs and everything like that. But this is such a fun time of year, and I've also been watching college basketball for the first time this year, and you appreciate the differences, but the single off elimination is really fun. But last thing, if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. Not the greatest at replying, though I do at times. It depends. That's why I think of it as feedback, not starting a conversation or something like that. But that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.